South during World War II provided a major boost. A later history, Southern Baptists in the Intermountain West credited the buildup of military bases and war industries, noting that between 1940 and 1974, SBC Western membership grew from 2 small state conventions in New Mexico and Arizona to 10 state conventions, 145 associations, 2,210 churches, 35,387 baptisms, and 689,139 members. The county-by-county maps of the influence of religious denominations during this same period show a steady SBC advance, on one hand consolidating within the boundaries of the old Confederacy, and on the other chalking up inroads in the border states, as well as in eastern New Mexico, Little Texas, Oklahoma, southeastern Kansas, and southern Illinois. By 1990 and 2000, the expansion was wider still. The greatest concentrations in western states were often in rural counties, but sometimes they were in metropolitan areas with a country music presence, Wichita, Kansas, and Bakersfield, California, ties to oil, Casper, Wyoming, and Fairbanks, Alaska, or prominence as a Christian evangelical mecca, Colorado Springs, Colorado. In any event, maps which display not only the Southern Baptist Convention-dominated states of the Greater South, but also the outliers where the SBC was one of the top 4 religious denominations, clearly establish the West as the principal adjunct to the South. Historian Edwin Gostad, in his new Historical Atlas of Religion in America, underscored the contrast between the SBC and the less effective Northern Baptists. By 1990, he wrote, the Southerners found themselves in Pennsylvania and New York, in the Old Northwest, in the Great Plains, and ultimately in California, Oregon, Washington, and even Alaska. Southern no longer referred to a region, but to a culture and an evangelical mode. Given the enormous size of the Southern Baptist Convention, this shift represented something of a thrust in the direction of the Southernization of American religion as a whole. Journalist Appleborn, in Dixie Rising, made a related but larger point. In a way that once would have seemed a contradiction in terms, Southern Baptists were no longer geographically Southern Baptists. Beginning in 1942, when they spread to California, Southern Baptist congregations have set up shop in every state in the Union. Now there are 1,900 black congregations, 3,000 Hispanic ones, and 800 Korean ones, a denomination speaking 101 languages, endlessly morphing and reproducing itself across the country, like a Southern gene, bringing both the good news of Jesus and the conservative values of the small-town South with it. In the states of the old Confederacy, most of the SBC churches are English-speaking, but this is not the case in the West. Almost any metropolitan area could illustrate the point. The Sacramento Association of Southern Baptist Churches includes the following ethnic congregations: Chinese, 1, Vietnamese, 1, Mien Laotian, 1, Hmong, 1, Russian, 3, Romanian, 1, Korean, 3, Hispanic, 4, and Filipino, 1. Black SBC churches are also many and increasing. In discussing Southern Baptists, then, clearly we are not talking just about WASPs. Nationally, ever more importance is also attaching to ASPs, Asian Protestants, and LAPPs, Latin American Pentecostal Protestants. However, the SBC can fairly be said to constitute a white conservative Southern sphere of influence. Here, a brief return to the religious politics of race is in order. The SBC's cultural conservatism is not of the sort that inhibits non-white conversion and enlistment. What it does propound, though, is a conservatism of evangelical theology preoccupied with saving souls and dismissive of other designs, whether liberal sociology or government-run social welfare programs, to ameliorate the ills of society. The answers, say SBC preachers, lie in the Bible and in coming to Jesus. Government social welfare planning and programs, in this view, only get in the way of individuals' assumption of personal responsibility and salvation. In Divided by Faith, Evangelical Religion and the Problem of Race in America, Two Southern sociologists, Michael Emerson and Christian Smith, make a compelling case that evangelical beliefs support the status quo when they lead white Southerners to insist that persons of both races are masters of their own fates and salvation. White evangelicals lopsidedly believe that if blacks don't get ahead, it is because of black culture or lack of initiative, explanations that pivot on individual responsibility. Under evangelical theology, social structures are not the real problem, and government action and involvement are rarely the solution, or so white true believers usually conclude. To Emerson and Smith, these attitudes work to maintain racial divisions. However, although such beliefs make Southern whites unsupportive of legislation that many Southern blacks favor, they do not seem to turn conservative black congregations away from the SBC. On the contrary, their numbers have grown from virtually none in 1890 to 1,100 in 1990 and 2,700 in 2000. Still, whether we look at Southern Baptists or other denominations sprung from 18th and 19th century roots in the South or border states, their original imprint in the West and Midwest, if not the recent ethnic embroidery, essentially came from white migration from below the Mason-Dixon line. Billy Graham wasn't the only Southerner who spread Dixie's evangelical faith. This case has been documented in detail by Oregon sociologist Mark Shibley, who penned the Southernization entry in the Encyclopedia of Religion and Society. There, Shibley described his own research. He showed that virtually all the membership growth in evangelical churches during the 1970s could be attributed to growth in historically Southern evangelical churches. Moreover, Shibley found that the growth of Southern-style religion was especially marked outside the South and corresponds with regions that experienced high levels of in-migration from the South during the same period. Shibley's book, Resurgent Evangelicalism in the United States, showed that the pattern held through the 1980s. However, along the Pacific, especially in California, the 80s saw local culture start to reshape conservative Southern evangelical religion toward a more relaxed and liberal outlook. A further point, of course, is that the Southern-sprung religion spread across the West and Midwest was not all brought in by the SBC. Emigrants from the South and border states also brought restorationist or primitive denominations, Churches of Christ, Christian churches, and Churches of God, as well as holiness, Pentecostal, and charismatic sects. Chapter 6 will expand the portrait of conservative religion. One is partly reminded of how much ethnic maps of Europe had changed between 1871 and 1919. New ethno-religious lines and borders often mean new political battlegrounds, and it is to that uncertain clash to which we now turn. Chapter 6. The United States in a Dixie Cup, the New Religious and Political Battlegrounds. George Bush is an evangelical Christian. There is no doubt about that. The president's evangelicalism means he believes in the truth of the Bible, with a capital T, the virgin birth, the death of Christ on the cross for our sins, the physical resurrection, and most important, a personal relationship with Jesus. Richard Land, Chief Washington Representative of the Southern Baptist Convention, 2003. The religion gap is the leading edge of the culture war that has polarized American politics, reshaped the coalitions that make up the Democratic and Republican parties, and influenced the appeals their presidential candidates are making. Voters who say they go to church every week usually vote for Republicans. Those who go to church less often or not at all tend to vote Democratic. Susan Page, USA Today, 2004. For the first time since religious conservatives became a modern political movement, the President of the United States has become the movement's de facto leader. Dana Milbank, The Washington Post, 2001. The Bush administration's worldview is one grounded in religious fundamentalism. That is, it emphasizes absolutes, authority, and tradition, and a divine hand in history and upon the United States. Such a worldview is disastrous for a democratic system. David Domke, God Willing, 2004. Please reread the four epigraphs above. For the first time, the United States has a political party that represents, some say over-represents, true-believing frequent churchgoers. And theocracy, a subject once confined to the history books, has crept into current affairs journals. The Southernization of U.S. politics and the growing, glaring reorganization of the Republican Party around religion are like the chicken and the egg. Which came first is hard to say. The more crucial question for us today is how far the two interrelated processes can proceed. This is not the first time such a troubling confluence has occurred. Once before, when a U.S. political party in control of the White House became captive to an excessive Southern ideology and hawkishness laced with fundamentalism and adherence to Scripture, national governance was transformed and the Republic thrown off course. War became inevitable. No matter that the same party 3 decades earlier had scored a notable success by knitting a less belligerent South into a new and dominant electoral coalition, there seems to be a fundamental drive rooted in the South's haunted history, regional religion, and combative temperament. That earlier ill-fated political coalition was forged by the 7th U.S. President, Democrat Andrew Jackson. When he unseated President John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts in 1828 by sweeping the South, the border states, and Pennsylvania, Jackson initiated a cycle of Democratic White House domination that lasted until the Great Sectional Crisis of 1860. As president from 1829 to 1837, he squelched South Carolina's attempted nullification of federal law in 1832, an early harbinger of disunion. But Jackson died in 1845, before the excesses of the Cotton States precipitated a fierce national debate. In Northern eyes, the slaveholding hauteur of the South was becoming unacceptable, touching old regional and cultural divisions still with us today. Martin Van Buren, originally Jackson's Secretary of State and later his Vice President, became the Northern spoiler for Democratic White House hopes in 1848 by running as an independent anti-slavery, free soil candidate, fatally splitting the old coalition in pivotal New York. Two of Jackson's former attorneys general shifted parties during the 1850s. One of them, Supreme Court Justice John McLean, received 197 delegates at the 1856 Republican Presidential Convention. Francis P. Blair, a leader of Jackson's kitchen cabinet, helped organize the GOP that year. Lewis Cass, once Jackson's Secretary of War, resigned from the Democratic administration of James Buchanan in 1860 because of its pro-Southern excesses. Two of Abraham Lincoln's new cabinet members in 1861, Treasury Secretary Salmon P. Chase of Ohio and Navy Secretary Gideon Welles of Connecticut, had earlier been Jacksonians. Rekindled sectionalism scripted new alignments. That was a long time ago, to be sure. No comparable party tremors shook the first administration of George W. Bush, save briefly in 2001 when Vermont Senator Jim Jeffords decided to leave the GOP, costing the party control of the upper chamber. Besides which, the 21st century Greater South commands a much bigger share of the nation's population and resources than did the ill-fated Confederate states. The North no longer has its former advantage. Unlike members of the Latter-day League of the South and other neo-Confederates, few New Englanders do more than joke about their own region's secession, although some might applaud a Southern departure. In this 21st century, of course, the North and South are no more likely to have a civil war than are Scotland and England or Ontario and Quebec. Even so, both of these quite relevant comparisons remind us how much ill will can endure in politics. Some contemporary U.S. tensions, moreover, do resemble those of the antebellum years. Sharp national divisions between the red and blue, instead of the blue and gray. War hawks shrilling from a perch in Dixie. Bibles being brandished as public policy guides. Pompous sermons proclaiming a chosen nation obliged to redeem the world. And fire-eyed preachers counting down to Armageddon, albeit in the Holy Land, not along the Potomac or Rappahannock. Too few of these symptoms, all in evidence before September 11, 2001, have been fully analyzed. Political hypotheses offered during 2004 about a metro-retro cleavage ignored the more significant historical precedents. And unfortunately, with respect to both Southern belligerents and the dangers of crusading religion, this historical dimension suggests the need for great caution. The second Bush term did provoke more candor among critics than the first had, especially with respect to the Republican Party's emergence as the political vehicle of the scripturally zealous and religiously observant. Some of the implications for national policymaking could hardly be ignored. The Middle East imbroglio was center stage, as was Washington's visible hostility toward the United Nations and its persistent difficulty in collaborating with international organizations. On another related front, the government began to defy science, notably biotechnology, climate studies, and straight-talking petroleum geology. As Chapter 7 will describe, there was theology, or pseudo-theology, motivating elements of the new politics. Those theological mainsprings, in turn, are substantially Southern. As W.J. Cash argued more than half a century ago in The Mind of the South, the problem is that while there are many Souths, the fact remains that there is also one South. As we have seen, its regional commitment is strong. Moreover, if John Shelton Reed is likewise correct about the cultural persistence of an enduring South, then its achievement of national leadership, census projections for population growth by 2020 and 2030 only underscore the new tilt, may ensure an enduring regional and religious tension. As we will see, religious excess and global crusaderism have fed off each other in prior leading world powers, and with dire results. To understand how these forces might impact America in the future, we must examine the extraordinary transformation of the Grand Old Party. Southerners and Republicans, the Great Reversal. Back in 1860, who could have guessed? Very few Southerners that year ever got a chance to vote for or against Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party. In the 11 states that shortly raised the Confederate flag, the nominee and his party, quite often equally despised, were simply not on the ballot. These states, for the most part, featured three-way races between the Southern Democratic contender, John Breckinridge of Kentucky, the Northern Democratic nominee, Stephen Douglas of Illinois, and the Constitutional Union choice, John Bell of Tennessee. The South Carolina legislature, uncommitted to any popular participation in choosing presidents, picked state Breckinridge electors itself. Missouri, Kentucky, and Maryland were scarcely less dismissive of Lincoln and the GOP. This makes the turnabout of the last century and a half so stark. The Republican presidential nominee took all 11 ex-Confederate states in both 2000 and 2004. Under George W. Bush, the rural and small-town Greater South became what GOP leaders reverently called the base. Party politics in the major Western nations offers no parallel to this great reversal. It is understandable only in light of one phenomenon: the transfer, over five decades, of deep-seated fealty to Southern folkways and sectionalism from the Democrats to the Republicans. So what psychology reversed? How and why? When post-war Reconstruction took the form of military rule in 1867, the Republican Party, having no prior electoral relationship to the ex-Confederate states, established one with the working end of a bayonet. Former slaves would be enfranchised, and biracial coalitions orchestrated by Northern advisors and expanded by white Southern Unionists, carpetbaggers and scalawags in the lexicon of white ex-Confederates, would elect Republicans to state and national office. In the end, that political Reconstruction fared little better than the parallel Northern bid to reconstruct Southern religion. The Democratic Party's defense of Southern white society would win it nearly a century of regional gratitude and fidelity. After a congressional commission gave Republicans the electoral votes of three disputed Southern states in 1876's stalemated presidential contest, no state in Dixie supported another GOP presidential nominee until 1920, when semi-isolationist Tennessee voted Republican largely to protest Woodrow Wilson's war policies and involvement in Europe. Then 1928 saw Southern Protestant objections to the Catholicism of the Democratic nominee, New York Governor Alfred E. Smith, produce Republican successes in Tennessee, Florida, and Texas. No other victory would follow until Dwight Eisenhower's breakthrough in 1952. Aroused by hostility to Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal, upper-income whites from Houston to Palm Beach and the Virginia Hunt Country had started voting Republican for president by 1940. But while this had significance in parts of the Outer South, it counted little in states such as Alabama, Arkansas, and Mississippi, where truly upper-income whites could be outvoted by a half-dozen fair-sized Baptist churches. Racial tensions broke away more voters in the late 1940s and 1950s. In 1952, Eisenhower carried three southern states, followed by five in 1956. Richard Nixon took three in 1960. Then conservative strategists let their ambitions below the Mason-Dixon line get out of hand. In 1964, by opposing civil rights legislation, Barry Goldwater carried the five states of the Deep South, but lost in the Outer South, and almost everywhere else. This electoral miscarriage inhibited future Republican strategies, demanding greater wisdom. After 1968, when Richard Nixon, making his second presidential bid, carried five southern states, Republicans held the White House for 20 years out of the next 24. The GOP enforced basic civil rights laws, but emerged as the party willing to appoint Dixie conservatives to executive and judicial positions and to oppose unpopular desegregation remedies, such as the busing of pupils to promote racial balance. In January 1972, Alabama Governor George Wallace's third-party candidacy, strong enough in segregationist sentiment and populist rhetoric in 1968 to garner electoral votes in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas, slipped into the past tense when he decided to run only in that year's Democratic presidential primaries. This played havoc in North and South alike. Northern Democrats, firmly in control of the party's 1972 delegate selection and nomination processes, responded to grassroots disarray by shifting leftward to nominate South Dakota Senator George McGovern. But even before that selection, the Washington rumor mill hummed with a related possibility. Just as the Republicans newly arrived in the Capitol in 1861 had been unable to control Congress until its Southern Democrats went home to put on Confederate gray, breakthrough in 1972 required another big fix, some kind of new double harness. Southern politicians interested in an overt alliance included ex-Governor John Connally of Texas, Senator Harry Byrd of Virginia, Mississippi Senator James Eastland, and Congressman Joe Wagoner of Louisiana, leader of the Southern conservative bloc in the House. National GOP strategists devoutly hoped, and national Democrats mightily feared, that under the right circumstances, the conservative Democratic Southern officeholders and influence mongers of congressional Washington would join up. Electoral momentum hurtled the South toward presidential Republicanism, which Dixie Democrats well understood. After World War II, the slow emergence of the second Reconstruction of the South, in this instance implemented by federal courts and U.S. Marshals, covered that same tense quarter century. Historians using that term included C. Van Woodward, Eric Foner, Dan T. Carter, Manning Marrable, and Richard Vallely. The enormity of Southern support for Nixon in the 1972 presidential election is still inadequately understood, mostly because its fruition between 1973 and 1976 was reversed by the Watergate scandal. I can remember being flabbergasted as I read the county-by-county figures weeks after the election. Two decades later, in The Vital South, How Presidents Are Elected, political science professors Earl and Merle Black looked back on those dimensions as astonishing. The most overwhelming Southern white vote, 79%, ever won by a Republican presidential candidate, a peak that still stands. The University of Michigan's National Election Studies for 1972 put Nixon's share even higher, at 82%. Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush never matched these levels. Nixon's shortfall was in not being able to enlarge the opportunity to include major congressional gains. Absent Watergate, some fusion of Southern Democrats and Republicans would almost surely have taken place. an unsullied Nixon would have claimed 62-63% of the presidential vote instead of 61%, avoided a stay-at-home moderate GOP protest movement, and pulled in 20-30 new Republican senators and congressmen instead of the net 10 seats actually gained. That increment, along with the omission of what by early 1973 became a blighting scandal, would have consummated high-level negotiations with 30-40 amenable Southern Democrats. As several accounts have rightly described, both the executive and legislative branches would have been reconfigured under some power-sharing arrangement. With Nixon destroyed, any hope of cross-party alliance fell apart, enabling the Democrats to narrowly win the 1976 presidential election. They did so with a born-again Southern Baptist ex-governor of Georgia, Jimmy Carter, who took 10 of the 11 ex-Confederate states, losing only Virginia. The role of the South in national politics was thrown back up into the air, or it appeared to be. On the day of Carter's inauguration in January 1977, Democrats controlled 9 of the 11 ex-Confederate governorships, 16 of the 22 Southern U.S. Senate seats, and almost three-quarters of the region's seats in the House of Representatives. The hemorrhage feared in 1972 had been avoided, and Carter's election pushed glum Republicans in Washington farther to the sidelines. The reduced percentage of Senate and House members from the South who were Republican in 1977 cut short the rise from just a handful in 1953 to not quite a quarter in 1969 and over 30% in 1973, postponing the sharp gains that early 1970s fusion would have brought until 1994. For a few years, Democrats dreamed of renewing their Southern and evangelical support, but in 1980, those hopes collapsed. Let me suggest an unacknowledged influence for the hiatus of the 1970s. Much of the short-lived post-1973 liberal renaissance produced by Watergate marshaled behind issues ultimately tied to religion. The Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision opening up the Pandora's box of legalized abortion, the secular campaign against school prayer, the excitement of women to put the Equal Rights Amendment into the Constitution, especially unpopular with religious conservatives committed to women's traditional role, and various aspects of the sexual revolution, gay rights, women's liberation, mainstream acceptance of pornography, and school or government distribution of contraceptives. All of these new issues surging to the fore angered conservative family values advocates. A 1972 fusion, by contrast, might well have reduced both the secular liberal pressure and the powerful counter-mobilization of the religious right. In retrospect, besides stalling electoral history, the delay ensured that the battle march would be onward Christian soldiers, not an occasional stanza of Dixie. As the new agenda led to culture wars, the Carter administration, despite its Southern accent, became an ambuscade for Democratic hopes below the Mason-Dixon line. Before further amplification, a central premise must be introduced. Among the vital, albeit unwilling, architects of the Republican Southern gains were the four Southern Democratic presidents of the second half of the 20th century. Three were Southern Baptists, Truman, Carter, and Clinton, and one belonged to the Disciples of Christ, Johnson. Over five decades, each pursued policies sought by national Democratic constituencies that strenuously contradicted traditional Southern stances on cultural, religious, foreign policy, and states' rights issues. Truman's desegregation of the military, his executive order prohibiting discrimination in federal employment, and other civil rights proposals spurred the 1948 revolt of the Dixiecrats, many of whom then took up GOP presidential voting in 1952. Johnson, in turn, alienated the core South with his advocacy of civil rights legislation and portions of the Great Society. Carter managed to annoy even his fellow Southern Baptists with his positions, and Clinton, despised in many of the region's churches, consummated the cultural and moral disenchantment. Racial policy, to some the obvious and all-encompassing explanation, in my opinion probably accounted for one-third to one-half of the white voter exodus that took place. Foreign policy, especially bungled war mismanagement, also offended the South, then and now America's most hawkish region. Truman and Johnson presided over the U.S. military embarrassments in Korea and then Vietnam. Carter often looked weak and in 1980 flubbed the rescue of the 53 Americans held hostage in Iran. Clinton's military image, in turn, took three wounds. From his youthful anti-Vietnam War stance, his impolitic emphasis during his first week in office on permitting gays to serve openly in the military, and the analogy posed by the Hollywood movie Wag the Dog, which caricatured a president who waged war in the Middle East to take Americans' eyes off a sexual liaison. Clinton profited on the economic front, but Truman, Johnson, and Carter all lost support by appearing to abet inflation, and the last of these suffered also from a re-election year recession. But if liberals tend to overstate race as the be-all and end-all, there is no doubt about its importance. The Democrats' crowning problem lay in a deepening mismatch with the cultural and religious viewpoints of their erstwhile bastion, the White South. When Democratic administrations were in office, Washington authorities were as much at odds with the Southern white majority as the carpetbaggers of old, which helps to explain the resentments unleashed. The centennial of the first Reconstruction, unpopular below the Mason-Dixon line, helped turn memory into working analogy. How many white Southerners, with their famous backward glance, perceived the essential role reversal? That over the years the Northern-run Democratic Party, albeit only informally, was the one using Southern-born presidents to implement a second Reconstruction and to build biracial coalitions along the lines pursued 100 years earlier by GOP firebrands such as House Speaker Thaddeus Stevens and Senate President Pro Tem Benjamin Wade. 100 years of lost cause worship had turned this regional sensitivity into a political nerve ending. In retrospect, the Democratic Party by the mid-1960s could elect no one but Southerners to the presidency, a tricky requirement that the nominees sensed. Even Johnson, the Texan who generally emphasized his home state's Western roots, deepened his drawl when he visited the South. However, all four were obliged to implement Northern liberal cultural agendas. By the 1990s, neo-Confederates were nicknaming them scalawags. The contemporary parallels cannot be ignored. In The Vital South, the Black Brothers pointed out that the Reagan campaign of 1980 also criticized Carter as a betrayer of Southern values. Wallace had made some of that case against Johnson, and Southern Republicans belabored Clinton with it. The president from Arkansas later chuckled about Southerners calling him a scalawag in the 19th century sense. They see me as an apostate. Conservative Democrats who had switched parties wielded this rhetorical saber with particular enthusiasm. In Mississippi, former Governor John Bell Williams told a 1980 crowd that Jimmy Carter took us down the boulevard of broken promises. Ridiculing Democrats who urged support for Carter because he's a Southerner born and raised in the South, Williams asked, "Do you see any indication of it in the last 4 years?" The assembled Mississippians roared, "No." Both Nixon and Reagan sharpened their appeals to the South with tangible policies as well as federal nominations. However, much of what they offered was symbolic. Nixon's rhetoric on busing and law and order, Reagan's 1980 embrace of states' rights in a visit to blood-stained Neshoba County, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers had been killed in 1964, his appearances with Jerry Falwell, and his jokes about welfare queens. Republicans knew now they had to sidestep the Goldwater trap of actual opposition to black civil rights. In fact, most of the great GOP advances below the Mason-Dixon line came from angry white responses to Southern and border state Democratic presidencies. As noted, Eisenhower's Southern breakthroughs in 1952 followed the Dixiecrat revolt of 1948 and the ensuing shifts of many Dixiecrat supporters in Low Country, South Carolina, the Mississippi Delta, and Bayou and Northern Louisiana to GOP presidential voting. Reactions against Lyndon Johnson's policies fueled the next big cluster of GOP Southern breakthroughs. Goldwater's sweep of the Deep South in 1964, the sizable congressional gains in 1966, including the South, the Democrats' 1968 loss of 10 of the 11 ex-Confederate states to Nixon and Wallace, and the Republican presidential crest of 1972 when the 1968 Wallace vote went to Nixon. Dissatisfaction with Carter fueled the next sequence. GOP midterm gains in 1978, including the Texas governorship, followed by the Reagan sweep in 1980, with its attendant major Southern congressional gains and capture of the Senate. Following these, the next big inroads, the fourth such sequence in the South, began in 1994, when a so-called midterm negative landslide against Clinton swung both the House and the Senate to the Republicans. The new leaders of the Senate were Majority Leader Trent Lott of Mississippi and Senate President Pro Tem Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, the Dixiecrat presidential nominee of 1948. The strong Dixie follow-up in the presidential election of 2000 and the 2002 congressional races also seems, as we will see, to hark back to the Southern-led 1998 impeachment of Clinton, with its accompanying revelations of immorality and Bible Belt outrage. Can these incremental Southern shifts be said to flow from the second Reconstruction? In considerable measure, but especially in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they can. By the 1990s, first under George H.W. Bush, then under Bill Clinton, and finally under George W. Bush, the mainsprings of U.S. politics were shifting from economics, race, and cultural symbolism to a new set of divisions rooted in beliefs and theology that transcended the simplistic values label left over from prior culture wars. Talk about the Republicans becoming a religious party akin to the Italian or German Christian Democrats began in 1988, grew in 1992 and thereafter, and caught hold in the George W. Bush years. The First American Religious Party. Since its founding, the United States has never had a national religious party of any kind, either one that was denominational or one that collected the religious of all faiths to fight secularism. Europe and Asia, of course, have had religious parties aplenty, specifically aligned with Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Hindu, Islamic, or Buddhist interests. These have principally marshaled one faith rather than mobilized religious intensity on a multi-denominational basis. By the second administration of George W. Bush, the Republican Party in the United States was on the road to a new incarnation as an ecumenical religious party, claiming loyalties from hard-shell Baptists and Mormons, as well as Eastern Rite Catholics and Hasidic Jews. Secular liberalism was becoming the common enemy. In the late 19th century, religion played a large enough role in voter choice of parties that many denominations displayed lopsided loyalties. In the Midwest, circa 1884, for example, the Yankee Congregationalists, Swedish Lutherans, and Welsh Methodists were overwhelmingly Republican, while German and Irish Catholics, Wisconsin Synod Lutherans, and Southern Baptists were lopsidedly Democratic. Conceivably, the most devoted worshipers were especially strong in their partisanship, but no survey takers left records. Among current-day Americans, however, polls and experts identify persons with the most intense religiosity and greatest frequency of attending services as the most Republican. Among Jews, the Orthodox, with their large families, somber clothing, and Old Testament mindset, take the Republican side, while secularized Reform Jews are heavily Democratic. Even with respect to Bible believers, though, quibbles arise. Religiosity often makes blacks, especially SBC adherents, more conservative, but it doesn't make black churchgoers as a class Republican. Nor does deep-seated liberal Christian theology make Episcopal or Unitarian feminists potential recruits for GOP women's groups. And theologians for the moderate liberal faction of the Southern Baptist Convention tend to be Democrats. Exceptions prove the rule, summed up by political analyst William Schneider. Since 1980, religious Americans of all faiths, fundamentalist Protestants, observant Catholics, even Orthodox Jews, have been moving towards the Republican Party. At the same time, secular Americans have found a home in the Democratic Party. This is something new in American politics. We have never had a religious party in this country. The United States, to be sure, is also the only major Western nation to be caught up in a powerful conservative religious tide. As recently as the early 1960s, national politics still operated in the lingering sunset of the Civil War-era denominational alignments. Mainline Protestantism was the central and sedately respectable image of the GOP, and there were jokes about the Episcopal Church being the Republican Party at prayer. The Democrats, for their part, still enjoyed lopsided support from Northern Catholics and Southern Baptists. By 1972, however, when the conservative counterattack against secularism and social liberalism registered its first great triumph, new cracks were visible in the old cement. According to a 2004 review of Gallup, CNN, USA Today polls, the religion gap didn't exist before 1972. Voters who said they went to church every week didn't vote any differently than those who did not. But after the tumultuous 1960s, President Nixon appealed to the traditionalist views of the nation's silent majority. A significant gap, 10 percentage points, opened in the 1972 election. That Republican 10-point edge among churchgoers has been ascribed to the fact that Nixon's opponent, George McGovern, came from the liberal activist wing of the Democratic Party, prompting Republican campaigners to label him the AAA candidate: acid, amnesty, and abortion. More recently, analyses by Jeffrey Lehman of Vanderbilt University and Louis Bolsey and Gerald DeMaio of the City University of New York provided a more measured explanation. Comparing national convention delegates and activists from 1972 to 1992, Lehman found that in 1972, secularists, atheists, agnostics, religious nuns, the unchurched, and the self-identified irreligious, most of them McGovern supporters, constituted the largest religious bloc among Democratic delegates. To Bolsey and DeMaio, the 1972 Democratic convention was tantamount to a secularist putsch, after which the party began driving out traditionalists with its ever more secularist positions. Nixon's support in 1972 among white, Southern regular churchgoers, most of them still registered Democrats, reached a stunning 86%, as measured by the American National Election Study. He drew 76% among members of SBC congregations, the latter being a somewhat lower-income slice of Southern voters. Elections analyst Samuel Lubell, in his prescient book The Future While It Happened, 1973, called Southern Baptists the group having the most explosive impact, who may have emerged holding the balance of voting power in the South and perhaps in the whole country. Nixon's speeches, in fact, seemed designed to appeal to the traits which characterize Baptists: an ingrained individualism, suspicions of government, and resentment of taxes. Baptists generally do not hold society responsible for man's failings, but believe that each man must find personal salvation by mastering his own inner soul and coming to know Jesus personally. They seem less concerned with changing society than with changing oneself. Largely unheralded, this was the debut of the Southern Baptists as a Republican electoral force. A still grander overview of the forces active in 1972 came from futurist Herman Kahn. The biggest movement in America in the 70s is the Counter-Reformation. Religions such as the Baptists, Church of Christ, Pentecostals, Jehovah Witnesses, and the Jesus Freaks are all on the same rise. I want to emphasize this because the United States is the only Western country that seems to be going through this Counter-Reformation on a large scale. But the Watergate scandal, besides destroying Nixon's presidency and the near-term Republican ability to capitalize on favorable trends, gave the Democrats the brief chance for a regional comeback in the election of Southern Baptist Jimmy Carter as president. The GOP's edge among churchgoers shrank as Southern Baptists in 1976 gave 51% of their votes to Carter, whose credentials ranged from teaching Sunday school to fluency in the convention's figurative language of Zion. The SBC had even published Carter's campaign biography, Why Not the Best, through its Boardman Press in 1975. Carter's misfortunes in the White House, while most glaring in the economic and foreign policy arenas, also had a powerful but less obvious religious component. Watergate's revitalization of liberal activism, as we have seen, escalated issues, from the Equal Rights Amendment to renewed efforts to take religion out of public schools, that were simultaneously provoking a religious counter-mobilization. Between 1977 and Ronald Reagan's first year in office, a half dozen new national organizations linked to religious conservatives emerged. The National Federation for Decency, 1977. Evangelist Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority, 1979. The Religious Roundtable, 1979. The Christian Voice, 1979. The National Affairs Briefing, 1980. The Council on Revival, 1980. And the Council for National Policy, 1981. By 1980, the president from Plains, Georgia, found himself in a crossfire akin to that which in 1979 had defeated his moderate faction allies in the Southern Baptist Convention. Grassroots sentiment had shifted to the right. Carter's own positions on the new religious agenda now displeased SBC adherents and pastors, 60% of whom approved of Falwell's Moral Majority. The Georgian never broke with the Southern Baptist Convention while president, but its earlier support of him chilled. In 1980, it passed a resolution calling Carter's White House Conference on the Family a general undermining of the biblical concept of family. Other resolutions opposed abortion and the Equal Rights Amendment. Surveys showed Carter handily surpassing Reagan in public perception as a religious person and man of high moral principles, but such abstractions seemed not to matter. The incumbent's Christianity was glum and quirky. Liberal Georgia historian Dan Carter later recalled the luckless president as a man who talked of limits and self-denial, of aggression and pain. At its heart, the science of governing was a willingness to engage in an endless struggle to control man's sinful nature. Under these circumstances, victory went to Reagan and his ability to mirror regional viewpoints and evoke the optimism of Southern Baptist evangelism and exceptionalism. Whereas Jimmy Carter had taken 10 of the 11 Southern states against Gerald Ford in 1976, Reagan won 10 in 1980, leaving Carter only his home state. Another significant change emerged in that year's U.S. Senate races. Catholic Republicans Don Nichols and Jeremiah Denton, both staunch conservatives, won seats in Oklahoma and Alabama, two states where anti-Catholicism had been visible in the presidential elections of 1928 and 1960. In 1980, with conservative traditional Catholics such as Paul Weyrich, Richard Vigeri, and Phyllis Schlafly captaining the religious right, that no longer mattered. Humanism and irreligion had become the common foe, another milestone in the emergence of an American religious party. Seeking re-election in 1984, Reagan took all 11 ex-Confederate states, winning percentages higher than any Republican nominee save Nixon. He, too, garnered a majority among Catholics. Even so, the former Hollywood actor was an unlikely president to orchestrate an across-the-board GOP appeal to church attendance and nuclear family togetherness. He and his wife didn't usually go to church, something he had acknowledged years earlier, although during his White House years he explained that his security arrangements would disturb worshipers. Clearly religious in his way, but also molded by Hollywood, Reagan was the only divorced president in U.S. history, let alone the only one to have been married to two movie stars. He had also had his share of family problems. One dysfunction came to light when his adopted son, Michael, raised a complaint. The then president had never bothered to see his grandchild, Michael's daughter, who was two. Further, the Reagan's daughter, Patty, eventually spited them by posing nude for Playboy. Nancy Reagan, in turn, had a long-standing interest in astrology, using it in planning her husband's activities and ultimately in checking the timeliness of his presidential schedule. This did not go unnoticed by religious traditionalists. In 1988, the Southern Baptist Convention had considered canceling a Reagan speech to their annual meeting following the revelation of how much attention the Reagans paid to the planets and stars. That same year, with U.S. evangelical and charismatic membership surging, the Christian broadcaster Pat Robertson, a Southern Baptist turned Pentecostal, decided on a bid for the Republican presidential nomination opened up by Reagan's retirement. Part of Robertson's assumption was that Vice President George H.W. Bush, as an Episcopalian and erstwhile Planned Parenthood and Equal Rights Amendment supporter, was too weak among true believers to win the nomination. When the dust settled, however, Bush had consolidated his Christian right support not just for the nomination, but for the November general election. In itself, this was a watershed of sorts. The elder Bush was ready to court the conservative Christian electorate in a way that Reagan had never found necessary. In 1988, Bush published Man of Integrity, a book detailing his own born-again status and close ties to leading evangelical leaders. His son became a key liaison. According to Newsweek, as a subaltern in his father's 1988 campaign, George Bush the Younger assembled his career through contacts with ministers of the then-emerging evangelical movement in political life. Nor did the Southern and religious emphasis end there. As his chief political aide, Bush Sr. chose Lee Atwater, a South Carolinian who specialized in go-for-the-jugular cultural politics. For vice president, he selected Indiana Senator J. Danforth Quayle, a conservative ally of the Christian right. The unusual religiosity of the 1988 campaign drew some well-deserved attention. For the first time in U.S. history, two prominent presidential candidates were clergymen, Robertson and Jesse Jackson for the Democrats. Southern historian C. Van Woodward found the year memorable because it was so thoroughly saturated with religious issues, conflicts, personalities, fanatics, candidates, scandals, and demagogues. Robertson's presidential bid led the Pentecostal Assemblies of God, his new army of foot soldiers, into Republican politics. They helped him to win caucuses in Hawaii, Alaska, Nevada, and Washington State, and to make respectable caucus showings in Minnesota, Iowa, and Michigan. By the general election, the Robertson organizers and Pentecostal rank and file had been recruited en masse by Bush, and surveys showed Assemblies of God ministers and activists as more than 90% Republican. The SBC, unsupportive of Robertson and his practice of speaking in tongues, had stuck by Bush in the nomination drive. State Republican parties were also moving to the right. In Oklahoma, the 1988 GOP state platform read like a Pentecostal critique of U.S. society. Opposition to homosexual marriage, New Age influence in education, abortion, surrogate motherhood, sex education, school-based health clinics and such. In Arizona, Robertson colluded with backers of ultra-conservative ex-governor Evan Meacham to write a Christian Reconstructionist state platform that declared the United States a Christian nation and asserted that the Constitution had created a republic based upon the absolute laws of the Bible, not a democracy. By the end of the 1990s, more than half of the 50 Republican state committees had been taken over by the religious right at least once. The Democrats, for their part, nominated Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, whose technocratic demeanor, commentator Gary Wills called him the first truly secular candidate for president in U.S. history, made George H.W. Bush look like a down-home Baptist deacon. The Republican nominee also adopted Robertson's indictments of Dukakis, his membership in the anti-religious American Civil Liberties Union, refusal to endorse the religious language in the Pledge of Allegiance, and imputed tolerance of child pornography, and found them effective. In a nutshell, Bush's courtship of the Christian right paid off. Some of this benefit drained away by 1992, after the name-calling Republican primary campaign waged against Bush by Patrick Buchanan over cultural issues. In the general election, independent presidential nominee H. Ross Perot diverted secular Republicans from Bush, and the Democrats put part of the old Confederacy back in play by selecting Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, a Southern Baptist, albeit one allied to the moderate liberal faction that was anathema to the SBC's ruling fundamentalists. Doubling his bet on the Upper South, Clinton selected another moderate liberal Southern Baptist, Tennessee Senator Albert Gore, as his running mate. Thus, after carrying all 11 ex-Confederate states against Dukakis in 1988, Bush held only 7, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Texas, while Clinton took Arkansas, Tennessee, Louisiana, and Georgia. The Southern Baptist Convention, fighting its own factional civil war, stuck with the GOP incumbent. Bush had spoken to the SBC's national meeting in 1991, tearfully reassuring the audience that the Gulf War had overcome his Episcopalian inhibitions about praying in public. Quayle addressed another national meeting in 1992, attacking abortion, homosexuality, and sex education, and characterizing the 1992 campaign as a war between traditional values and the agenda of the liberal cultural elite. The upshot, among white SBC voters, was a 49% to 37% Bush-Quayle lead over the all-Baptist Democratic team, in comparison to the 43% to 38% margin for Clinton over Bush in the nation as a whole. Even more revealingly, the Republican presidential edge among frequent church attenders jumped to 14%, 4 points higher than Nixon's breakthrough numbers 20 years earlier. In 1992, according to Vanderbilt University's layman, the religion gap had become unmistakable. Bolsey and DeMaio, in turn, reported that by the first Clinton election, divisions among party elites spilled into the general election and were so apparent in exit poll and public opinion data that one team of academic researchers identified 1992 alternatively as the year of the evangelical and the year of the secular. The vote distribution of white respondents who indicated that they had backed a major party candidate supports this assertion. Clinton carried 3/4 of the secular vote, while George H.W. Bush won 2/3 of the traditionalists. Data from Gallup and the Voter News Service likewise confirm 1992 as an inflection point for religious frequent attenders. Most of us, myself included, paid too little attention to this sea change, now startlingly clear in hindsight. Within weeks of Clinton's 1992 election, unfriendly state SBC conventions had passed resolutions recommending that the president-elect be guided by prayer and biblical principle. Floridians urged him to stop supporting abortion and homosexual rights, and delegates to the national SBC meeting in 1993 passed a resolution combining the two themes. Churchgoer dissatisfaction with Clinton boiled over by 1994, helping to bring about the Southern-led GOP takeover of Congress. Regular church attenders polled 8 points more Republican than other voters in the 1994 elections, the highest disparity in congressional contests to date. On the GOP side, party gains below the Mason-Dixon line in 1994 once again drew on local dissatisfaction with a Southern Democratic presidency. This was the first, however, to result in a takeover of Congress led by Southern Republicans. In 1953, when the GOP House of Representatives elected with Dwight Eisenhower convened, the geography of Republican control was still as northern as a blue Yankee uniform. The northeastern delegation was lopsidedly Republican, 64%, while members from the South were almost solidly Democratic, 92%. Even in 1973, when Watergate aborted GOP-Dixie fusion, the old blue-gray division still prevailed. The Southern upheaval in 1994 was the key to the congressional revolution. Even in 1997, as Congress remained Republican despite Clinton's re-election, the South sent the most Republican, 61%, of regional delegations to the House of Representatives, while the Northeast chose the most Democratic, 59%. Nearly a quarter century after George McGovern's defeat in 1972, the great reversal had finally come to Congress.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents American Theocracy by Kevin Phillips, read by Scott Brick. The election of 1996 requires no great attention because a voter backlash against new House Speaker Gingrich and the shrill GOP Congress countered some of the negative focus on Clinton, who won easy re-election. The president from Arkansas carried 4 southern states, his home state, Florida, Tennessee, and Louisiana, even though the GOP maintained its sway over southern House seats. However, the next great cultural and religious catalyst, Clinton's affair with White House intern Monica Lewinsky and his subsequent impeachment, was not far away. In retrospect, Considerable attention has justifiably focused on the apparent 1998 to 2002 influence of Bill Clinton. In their pre-2004 election analysis of what they called the new religion gap, John Green and Mark Silk, director of the Center for the Study of Religion in Public Life, found one possible explanation of the 1998 to 2002 trend arising out of the tawdry impeachment sequence. Although the country as a whole did not favor removing Clinton from office, a sizable number of frequent worship attenders may have been sufficiently distressed by the affair to change their voting habits. It is conceivable that, in the late 1990s, an increasing number of frequent attenders transferred their moral disapproval of Clinton onto his party as a whole. An analysis by Zogby International of its own polling data struck a similar note. On the political, economic, and social values espoused by the Clintons, a solid majority of red state voters reject the Clintons' values, 56%, while 34% agree. Blue state voters split almost evenly, 45% favorable, 47% unfavorable. Early in the 2004 election campaign, an analysis by USA Today of that newspaper's shared Gallup poll data also touched on the Clinton effect. Bill Clinton, dogged by rumors that he dodged the draft and cheated on his wife, won the 1992 election because of his promise to address voters' concerns about the economy and health care. But those who attended church each week were much less likely to support him than others. In 2000, George W. Bush emphasized the role that his born-again faith had played in turning around his life. The gap got bigger. In some ways, George W. Bush had approached the 2000 election as a cross between political project and biblical mission. In 1999, he told an assemblage of Texas pastors that he believed God had called him to run. That same year, he spoke to the Council for National Policy, a group that included religious right leaders and some Christian Reconstructionists. No text of that meeting has ever been released. In one televised debate in 2000 with his rivals for the GOP nomination, Bush, upon being asked to identify the thinker who had most influenced him, stunned viewers with his answer: Christ. If the elections of 1988 and 1992 had unusual religious components, the election of the millennium had even more, although, once again, hindsight provides illumination. Well before September 11, 2001, religion and intensity of faith and worship were emerging as the principal dividing lines in national politics. The religious party that Ohio political scientist John Green and others had tentatively discerned in the 1988 electoral tea leaves was becoming a reality, as poll data proclaimed. From 10 points in its unheralded 1972 debut, the religion gap dropped to single digits for two decades. Then it jumped back into prominence, 14 points in 1992, expanding 8 years later to a record 20 points. Although legitimate doubts were raised about frequency of attendance at services being the best measure, the basic thesis of religiosity's importance gained wide acceptance. The whys and wherefores were clear enough. To Jeffrey Lehman, the two parties' positions on issues, especially moral issues like abortion, gay marriage, and prayer in schools, have grown increasingly polarized, and it's these issues that are the key to the religious split between the parties. This is something we're seeing across the country. Religion watcher John Green explained that once social issues came to the forefront, abortion, gay rights, women's rights, it generated differences based on religious attendance. Theology was beginning to exert real electoral influence. Although the 2002 midterm elections were influenced by the memory of September 11th and saber-rattling over Iraq, they also extended the 2000 pattern, which was shaped by religion, morality, and anti-Clinton sentiment. In the 2000 congressional races, frequent attenders at religious services were 18 points more Republican than the overall electorate, and in 2002, the congressional religion gap widened to 20 points. According to Green, frequent attending white Protestants turned out in significantly higher numbers in the South than in other regions of the country, and that fueled impressive GOP victories south of the Mason-Dixon line. The election of 2004 did not greatly change the alignments of 2000, but it did highlight small trends and offer clarifications. The fallout of September 11th on religious voters, for example. Of the forces redefining the National Republican electorate. It is to these contours that we now turn. Born Again Republicans, 2004 and the New Religio-Political Map. By 2004, some 43 to 46% of Americans described themselves as born again in Christian faith, although perhaps half of those would not have passed a strict set of 3 or 4 follow-up criteria. At the same time, some 40% of Americans said they frequently attended religious services, although some academics thought 30% would be a more truthful figure. Combining both groups, with their admittedly large overlap, reasonably religious voters cast close to half of the nation's votes. Among whites, some 70 to 75% supported George W. Bush and represented by far the largest portion of his electoral coalition. As USA Today said in introducing its poll analysis, forget the gender gap. The religion gap is bigger, more powerful, and growing. If the religion gap has indeed become the most important denominator of American voting patterns, then we ought to be able to draw a good map of what happened in the Bush-Kerry contest using religious data and denominational concentrations. And, indeed, we can. The map of red Republican states facing blue Democratic states, between 2000 and 2004, 2, Iowa and New Mexico, shifted to the red side and 1, New Hampshire, to the blue side, suffices to begin the conversation. Before the 2004 ballots were cast, pollster John Zogby took the red-blue divisions of 4 years earlier and explained their most revealing components. In the red states, collectively, 57% of the voters were Protestant, 23% were Catholic, and 1% was Jewish. Those in the blue states were 37% Protestant, 33% Catholic, and 4% Jewish. More red state voters were married, 64%, than were blue state voters, 56%. In the blue states, 20% were single as opposed to 10% in the red ones. Urbanites, college graduates, younger voters, Catholics, Jews, and union members were more numerous in the blue states, while the red bloc had the edge in born-again Christians, gun owners, rural dwellers, conservatives, and military veterans. What slowly became clear about the 1994 to 2004 decade was that different denominations, theologies, intensities of faith, and secularisms bred disparate viewpoints on issues such as abortion, family roles, prayer, the definition of marriage, and gay rights. Banners of the so-called culture wars for a quarter century, the salience of these concerns to fast-growing conservative Christian denominations in particular, helped to make religiosity, biblical fundamentalism, and theology increasingly vital keys to U.S. electoral behavior. Talk about supposed values had long muddied the underlying divisions. In the 2004 exit polls, values meant one thing to supporters of Ralph Nader and a very different set of topics to conservatives. For true believers, commitment to biblical inerrancy is a theological mandate. The belief that society can be seriously reformed only by saving souls, not by embracing government welfare or manipulation, has become a tenet of evangelical religion, not just a mere value. Values are what society holds. What churches hold is theology and belief. I have profiled some of the disparate views substantially shaped by religious intensity and denomination. Much in electoral politics, in turn, can be clarified by identifying the concentrations of key denominations and theologies in different sections of the United States. Viewed through that lens, the outcomes make more sense. To begin with, the 2000 and 2004 elections, narrowly won by George W. Bush, constitute an uncommon pairing. Unusual because presidents who get elected in close races and then go on to obtain a second term usually do so by opening up broad support, thus winning that race handily. Jefferson in 1804, Lincoln in 1864, McKinley in 1900, Nixon in 1972. Bush's 50.7% share in 2004, by contrast, was the weakest for an incumbent since Woodrow Wilson in 1916. and even Wilson raised his vote share by nearly 8 points between 1912 and 1916. What this suggests, and what the voting data amplifies, is that his presidency rested on an uncommonly narrow base. Among religions and denominations, Bush had both gains and losses. White evangelicals increased their support from 72% in 2000 to 78% in 2004. John Green, the religious voting expert, hesitated about overcrediting evangelicals. He noted that religious conservatives were absolutely critical to President Bush's re-election, but it was a broader coalition of religious groups. Central to that group were evangelical Protestants, but it also included Catholics, black Protestants, and other groups as well. The influence cut across racial and cultural lines. Black support for Bush, up from 8% in 2000 to 11% in 2004, was greatest, 22%, among frequent church attenders. Much of this gain pivoted on the gay marriage issue, which was emphasized by many black pastors. Among Jews, Bush's support jumped from not quite 20% in 2000 to about 25% in 2004. Well below what his advisors hoped for, the improvement largely depended on Jewish groups associated with Israel's religious right. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, approximately a quarter of American Jewish voters cast their votes for Bush this time, as opposed to 18.5% 4 years ago. Experts calculated that about 85% of Orthodox Jews and about 95% of Haredi Jews voted for him. The high birth rate in these two communities helps to explain the significant rise in Jewish votes that went to the Republicans. The Orthodox group, 8% of all U.S. Jewish voters, included both Hasidic and Haredi Jews, the latter being the ultra-Orthodox, including Lubavitchers, whose small independent Israeli party in 2005 belonged to the governing right-wing Likud coalition in the Jerusalem parliament that was closely tied to the Bush administration. On the other side of the demographic ledger, Republican support from the U.S. Muslim population of some 4 million plummeted from a solid majority in 2000, credited in some quarters with helping to carry Florida for the party, to between 10 and 20% in 2004. Muslim majorities in urban southeastern Michigan, Islam's largest U.S. population concentration, in Dearborn, local McDonald's even have halal chicken McNuggets, helped carry that state. Among U.S. Protestants, Bush paid for gains on the right by losing some mainline Protestants, once the Republican base. Analyst Green told a television interviewer that in 2004, Bush got a majority of mainline Protestants, but his support was down a little bit from the 2000 election, particularly among the regularly attending mainline Protestants. This was one real bright spot for the Kerry campaign among religious groups. A lot of those regularly attending mainline Protestants have a somewhat more liberal theology and care about issues like the environment and poverty. The conservative Republican Victory Coalition included the Southern Baptist Convention core states in the old Confederacy, plus the adjacent layer in the old border, West Virginia, Kentucky, Missouri, and Oklahoma, and beyond these, the SBC's 20th century extension into western states, where by 1990 it had become one of the top four religious denominations. The national SBC provides the most important color base of the red state map. The rest of the GOP's critical religious geography includes the Mormon concentration, which is centered on Utah and southern Idaho, but also extends into Oregon, Nevada, Montana, Arizona, and New Mexico. In the 1890s and 1900s, when the Republicans controlling Washington finally came to terms with the Church of Latter-day Saints, making Utah a state, 1896, and later seating Reed Smoot, a Mormon apostle, in the U.S. Senate, hearings stretched between 1904 and 1908, part of the motivation was electoral. GOP strategists had literally drawn a map. Of the 11 states or territories along or west of the Rockies, 7 had significant Mormon populations, making the church a potential broker in national politics. The calculus, partly that of President Theodore Roosevelt, was sound. In 2004, U.S. Mormons, now 10 times more numerous, gave 88% support to George W. Bush and their Western concentration underpins the GOP domination in Utah and Idaho and assists in the other Rocky Mountain states. The next group involves the leading restorationist or primitive denominations, Churches of Christ, Christian churches, the top holiness groupings, Church of the Nazarene, the Indiana-based Church of God, and the conservative Pentecostals, Assemblies of God, Pentecostal Assemblies, and the Tennessee-based Church of God. Most of these had southern or border state origins, and their highest ratios are still concentrated in the South, the border states, the Ohio Valley, the lower Great Plains, and the West. Most of the states in which these denominations concentrate are part of the Red Bloc, with the principal exceptions of Oregon and Washington, which in addition to major concentrations of holiness and Pentecostal denominations, also have unusually high secular ratios. To round out this portrait, include the arch-conservative Missouri Synod Lutherans, 2.5 million strong, and the moderate conservative Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, 4.5 million. The latter took shape in 1988 from a merger of three mid-sized denominations, themselves formed by the earlier amalgamation of dozens of small German and Scandinavian ethnic Lutheran denominations. Although Lutherans dominate in a number of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Missouri counties, their overwhelming population ratios and regional dominance concentrates in the upper Midwest. Missouri Synod Lutherans appear to have backed Bush by about 4-1 in 2004, and his 55-60% support among more centrist ELCA voters presumably varied by ethnic group and degrees of individual church attendance. Along with church-going Texas and Utah, the Lutheran strongholds of the Northern Prairie display some of the nation's highest ratios of church membership as a percentage of total population. Conservative, pro-religious politics in these areas are intense, just as secularism and non-affiliation reach their highest ratios along or near the East and West coasts in technology, university, and counterculture centers such as San Francisco, Silicon Valley, Seattle, and Boston. From Southern fundamentalists and Midwestern Germans to Rocky Mountain Mormons, this religious geography helps to explain the deep-hued scarlet of the core red states. On the periphery, Wisconsin and Minnesota are the swing states of Eastern Lutherdom. What was once the border in post-Civil War U.S. politics, from Maryland through West Virginia and Kentucky westward through Missouri to Oklahoma, lost that status in 2000 and 2004. Overwhelmingly urban and suburban Maryland has been absorbed into the northeastern megalopolis that runs from Washington to Boston, while the remaining four states are sufficiently influenced by Southern Baptists, other conservative Baptists, Restorationist and Holiness denominations, and Pentecostals to qualify as traditionalist redoubts. Religio-politically, the new border runs from southern Pennsylvania across Ohio through southern Indiana and Illinois to Iowa. In 2000 and 2004, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Iowa were all battlegrounds. Rural and small city southern Pennsylvania has the Northeast's closest approximation of a Bible Belt. In the West, presidential showdowns over the religion gap took place in Oregon and Washington, where Pacific Coast secularism, the nation's height of irreligion, meets the westward flow of Mormons, Southern Baptists, Assemblies of God, and Nazarenes. A second set of Western battlegrounds lies in the Southwest, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado. Here, emigration and influence from California, Northern retirees, Hispanic Catholics, and artistic, resort and vacation home communities bump into large Mormon, conservative Baptist, evangelical, and Pentecostal contingents, some of them Latino, as well as the Little Texas conservative cultural extensions in New Mexico and Colorado. As we will pursue further in the afterword, demographics favor the conservatives because the evangelical, Pentecostal, and fundamentalist denominations ranked as the fastest-growing ones at the turn of the century, outweighing the expansion of the secular, unaffiliated, or non-religious element. The politics, however, are more problematic. Theories of how the 43rd president takes after the ideology of Reagan, not of his father, the 41st president, generally ignore a third alternative. the younger Bush's considerable echo of the conservative political fundamentalism displayed by Barry Goldwater. In the annals of late 20th century American conservative strategy, the 38.5% of the national electorate won by Goldwater in 1964 stands as the nadir, while the 59% won by Reagan in 1984 is the apogee. George W. Bush's 50.7% support in 2004 falls in the middle statistically.